This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Since it was first published in 1995, James W. Loewen's book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong, has sold over 2 million copies. In 2018, a new edition of the book was released with a new preface written by Loewen for what he calls the Age of Alternative Facts. We had a delightful conversation that summer about the book, and since he passed away, I'd like us all to take another listen to that conversation. I started by asking him why they issued a new edition of the book that year.
Interesting question. The first answer I would give is the book keeps selling. It was selling before this reissue 100 copies a day, which is pretty good for a book that originally came out in 1995. So people still find it meaningful and are giving it to other people and all that kind of stuff. But then, as the new preface in the new edition talks about, we are in a particularly interesting era for a book called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Some people call this era the post-truth era, or the alternative fact era. So we've got a number of forces going on. Some of these forces are in academia even, that kind of make it harder for people, just everyday people like myself or yourself, to think about truth and falsity. If we think about where we got our notion of how the world is. Somebody famously said the first draft of history is journalism. Well, it used to be from, let's say, the major paper in whatever city you lived in. There's only a few cities that had more than one. But newspapers, as everybody knows, are in a much weakened state owing to the web. So the number of reporters on a paper has dropped astoundingly, and the amount of news that they produce is down in both quality and quantity. So that's not as important a source for most people nowadays. Instead, we have the internet. Well, the internet is great in some ways. It certainly allows lots of voices to speak, but they aren't vetted as well as, let's say, even newspapers were. And they're also not voices that bring us together. Everybody can find their own voice. You know, some people, and the same is true for cable TV. Now that we have 700 channels, some people will listen to MSNBC. Some people will listen to Fox. Very few people will listen to both. So the result is that everybody kind of has their own truth, and the line between truth and opinion gets blurred. So that's the first problem. And then we have a problem going on in academia, and it's been going on for more than 20 years, particularly in history and in the humanities. Here's a line I keep hearing in graduate school. Why should we privilege one narrative above others with the term true? In other words, that there's not exactly such a thing as a truth that we can all say is objective, and that's it. Well, I think that sounds very sophisticated and very nuanced, but I think it's actually too simple and not adequate. I reply, yeah, right. And the Civil War started in about 1875 in Nevada. It grew out of a pay dispute between the Chinese railroad workers and the Union Pacific. And people look at me like I'm crazy, which, of course, that statement is. And they say, but that's not true. And, of course, it isn't true. And there is a bedrock of fact. And then I go on and I say, well, okay, that one might be too easy because I got the date wrong, I got the place wrong, I got the cause wrong, I got the people wrong. What about this one? The South seceded for slavery and did not secede for states' rights. In fact, it seceded against states' rights. And I submit that the evidence for that is absolutely as completely uncontradicted and as cut and dried as the evidence for the Civil War started in Charleston, South Carolina in 1861. Yet people think, well, that's a topic of nuance. There's different perspectives. Does that help get to why I thought we needed a new edition of Lies My Teacher Told Me?
It certainly does, especially given I saw in the book, you talk about the Vietnam War. And of course, I was alive. We were both alive during that. We both read press coverage of the Vietnam War. And yet, depending on which paper you read, you got a different story of the war. And then the government was telling a whole different one.
So, well, there was that's true. It gradually facts did emerge. It actually wound up being our most photographed war and the war that had the most journalism going on in it, because our Iraq war, or both of them, and our Afghanistan war, they have these embedded journalists, but they're kind of under the care and feeding, if you will, of the armed forces. And by definition, they see what they're shown. But in Vietnam, there are all these journalists just running around the place, you know, under nobody's control. And gradually, I think the truth came out. In fact, if you look at public opinion polls on the war in Vietnam, you found that by the time the United States gets out, the vast majority of Americans believe that it was a mistake to have gone in and believe it was a mistake both morally and also politically, that is, in terms of our realpolitik, our national interests. It didn't do us any good. And I think that the vast majority today would say the same thing for our second war in Iraq. So anyway, interestingly, you look at what the textbooks tell us about Vietnam, and the further we get from it, it's not getting any better. It was terrible then, and it's even worse now. The textbooks are much worse than the journalism was.
Well, let's get into this. This book is not a rewrite of the original book, correct? This is just you put a new preface on this to kind of, you know, yeah, just.
That's right. I did revise the book thoroughly in 2007, and in order to do that, I read six more United States history textbooks. People need to know that Lies, My Teacher Told Me, is based on my intensive reading of, by now, 18 high school history textbooks. I joke, but it's true. No one else has ever attempted this feat. I mean, they are so boring that I don't think teachers read them. Students sometimes have to read them, but I don't think anybody else does. I think they look at them. And one of my pieces of evidence for that was when I wrote the second edition in 2007, I came upon the fact that two of these six new books that I was evaluating by two completely different sets of authors had a chapter that was almost identical. It was identical for page after page. The photos were identical, the captions were identical, and the main prose text was identical, except one of them might have a very in it, and the other one didn't have the word very, like they had gone through two different sets of copy editors, but it was identical prose. So I called up the authors, Boorstin and Kelly. Daniel Boorstin was the chief librarian of the Library of Congress. That's a very important post. Brooks Mather Kelly was the chief archivist of Yale University. I called up Kelly. I couldn't call up Boorstin because he had just died. And Kelly initially says, when I start asking about the new chapter, Boorstin did it, by which he doesn't mean Boorstin copied. He means Boorstin wrote it. Pretty soon I tell him, did you know that for page after page, it's identical to this chapter in this other book called Pathways to the Present, written by four guys over at Miami University in Ohio? And he said, and I quote, oh, no, that's terrible. Pretty soon, he admits that Boorstin didn't write it. He said, Pennesall hired somebody to write it. I forget the man's name, which means here we have these two famous historians that put their name on a book, but they don't even know who wrote it or the qualifications of who wrote it, nor do they read it. So then I called up the other guy, the person at Miami University who supposedly wrote his chapter, and he implied that he wrote it. And then I told him, did you know that for page after page, it's identical to this book by Boorstin and Kelly? And he said, well, I don't even own that book. But pretty soon he admitted he did not write it either. Okay. And I said to him, well, aside from the fact you didn't write it, what do you think about it as a work of history? And he said, just a minute, let me get it down from the shelf. Meaning, how would I know? I never read it. So these folks, you know, when I give this lecture to college students, I say, now look, if you're stupid enough to buy your term paper for $9.95 off the web, I hope you at least have brains enough to read the darn thing before you hand it in to the professor. There's no quality control whatsoever. So the people writing the Vietnam chapter, they don't have any particular knowledge about it. They're not even necessarily historians. They may just have a BA in English.
When you wrote this book, when it came out, did you expect it to be as popular and as revolutionary as it was?
Well, in a way, I did. I had the following. Well, let me say this. For some reason, and I don't have a personalized fear of dying. A lot of people don't, it turns out. I know this because I once got into a discussion group at my church up in, when I lived in Vermont, and there were about 25 people in the group, and we split about evenly of people who really do fear death and people who really don't. And I fit into that second group. But during the time that my teacher told me was almost out, I really worried when I descended in an airplane and we had rough weather or, you know, when anything threatening like that happened, because I really wanted to stay alive until it got out because I thought it would be good. My vision was, and I have no idea where this came from, that it would sell 116,000 copies in hardbound and be on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 weeks. Well, that's not quite what happened. What happened was it sold about 55,000 copies initially in hardbound. It never hit the New York Times bestseller list, but it did hit the bestseller list in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in Boston, in various other places, and it's been the top seller in historiography, its category at Amazon, continuously from 1995 on, and so now it's sold close to 2 million copies. So I never had that dream. Historians actually kind of like the book because, and in fact, they recruited me into the to be a distinguished lecturer for the Organization of American Historians, even though I'm a sociologist. Anybody, for instance, who teaches the Civil War likes what I say about the Civil War. They don't know anything about, let's say, Columbus, and I have a chapter about Columbus. But the people who teach about Columbus, they like what I say about Columbus, and they maybe learn something from what I wrote about the Civil War. You know, historians, unfortunately, like the rest of us in academia, are so split up that very few people know much about the whole sweep of American history.
Still to come, our 2018 conversation with James Loewen continues with a story about a teacher who had issues with the book's title. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and today we're listening to my conversation with James Loewen, author of the groundbreaking book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. Loewen passed away last month. A new edition of the book was released in 2018, and that's when we spoke. In the new foreword for that edition, he wrote that some teachers initially rejected the book because of the title.
One teacher did in particular, and I found this out because it was in Burlington, Vermont, and I used to live in Burlington. And by the time this escapade happened, I was living where I live now in Washington, D.C. But I did a workshop for K through 6 teachers, or maybe K through 5 teachers in Burlington. I didn't usually do workshops for kindergarten and first and second grade, but anyway. And there was one teacher who absolutely was upset that she had to go to this workshop and that the school district would offer one called Lies My Teacher Told Me. Well, the book does not bash teachers. I admit that the title does, but the book does not bash teachers. It's mainly an attack on textbooks. It is an attack on teachers if they only rely on the textbook, but it's not a teacher bashing book. And so I did the workshop, and she vowed she would never read the book. And then I heard back from I knew people in Vermont, so I heard back from somebody who taught with her that she had been seen reading the book, but she put the cover of some other book on top of it so that nobody knew she was reading it.
All right.
In summary, what do we get wrong about history? I mean, is there a common thread of the mistakes, or is it just all over the place?
There are a couple of common threads. It's not just random mistakes. There are plenty of just random mistakes, partly because, as I already noted, the people writing the books they don't really care about it. I mean, their name isn't on it. They are just clerks deep in the bowels of the publisher, and the authors don't read the books, the so-called authors, the authors whose names are rented. So there are plenty of just random mistakes. I mean, one random mistake in a book that I did not review, an older book, but it became quite famous, had President Truman ending the Korean War by using nuclear bomb. Now, this would be news to Dwight Eisenhower, who campaigned for the presidency on the platform, among other things, that I will go to Korea and I will end this war. That's a random mistake. But I think there's two kinds of general mistakes. First, the biggest overall mistake is that we Americans started out great, and we've been getting better ever since, kind of automatically. Everything's been getting better and better. Now, in some ways, that's true. There are some things that have been getting better, but almost everything has its ups and downs. And the downs, such as this era called the nadir of race relations, this is the period 1890 to about 1940, when race relations actually got worse all across the country. We can't even discuss them in the textbook because it doesn't fit with this overall narrative, which is everything always got better. So that's the biggest single lie, if you will. It didn't always get better, and it doesn't get better automatically. And then the second biggest, it's not exactly a lie, it's a problem. The textbooks don't want to say anything bad about anybody. Well, there's a couple of exceptions, but and my example that I give is Franklin W. Pierce. People say, who? He, of course, was one of the presidents around the 1850s who that we don't remember very well. He was just before Buchanan. He was actually terrible. He's my candidate for the second worst president in the history of the whole country. He was a total pro-slavery Democrat, even though he's from New Hampshire. He was drunk during most of his presidency. All kinds of bad things happened during his presidency, some of which he deliberately caused. It was so bad that he's the only president in the history of the country who ever wanted to be renominated after winning election the first time, and his home party wouldn't renominate him. And when he got off the train in New Hampshire after his term of office, nobody met his train, which is kind of interesting. That's how bad he was. Well, do textbooks say anything like what I just said? Well, no, because he's the only president New Hampshire ever produced, you know? And now his fame has kind of eclipsed the facts, and so he has a very bland historical marker at the state capitol about this maybe kind of good president. There's a college named for him, blah, blah, blah. So if the textbooks can't tell us anything bad about Franklin W. Pierce, who can they tell us anything bad about? Nobody. And so as a result, that not only makes them wrong lots of times, it also makes them boring all the time.
So why is history important in the first place?
Well, I'm a sociologist, and so that question hit me upside the head because my first full-time teaching job was at a black college, Tougaloo College. It's over in Mississippi, and Tougaloo is a very good college. It's a small college. It's in faraway Mississippi. Most folks haven't heard of it. I spent 7 years there, but my first year, I was teaching the courses I expected to be teaching in sociology, but I was also asked to teach and did teach one section of what they call the Freshman Social Science Seminar. And this was a course that was invented by the History Department, and it used African-American history as its framework, which made sense since 99%+ of our students were African-American. And it introduced students to, you know the drill, my discipline, sociology, anthro, poli-sci, psych, econ. And it, as I mentioned, did this in the framework of African-American history. Well, when you're in that framework, that's the same chronology as, shall we say, regular American history. So second semester starts not just after Christmas, but second semester starts also after the Civil War, with the period known as Reconstruction, of course. So I found myself with 17 new students that first day of class in January. I didn't want to do all the talking, so I asked them, okay, what is Reconstruction? What happened then? And 16 of 17 of my students told me Reconstruction was the period right after the Civil War when blacks took over the government of the southern states. But they were too soon out of slavery, and so they screwed up, and white folks had to take control again. And I thought, I mean, that was kind of an aha moment, or maybe I should call it an oh-no moment, because None of that happened. I mean, black folks never took over the southern states. All of the southern states had white governors throughout the period. All but one had white legislative majority as well. The Reconstruction governments did not screw up. Without exception, across the South, they wrote the best state constitutions that the states have ever had, including better than the ones that they labor under today. They did all kinds of interesting things. Mississippi, in particular, had better government during Reconstruction than at any later point in the 19th century. There's just so many things wrong with that. Too soon out of slavery, there's a concept, as if slavery was trying to educate you, which it was not. It was a felony to teach blacks how to read or write, even free blacks during slavery. So I'm thinking, my God, how terrible it is to believe that the one time your group was center stage in American history, they screwed up. Now, if it was true, that's a different matter. We have to figure this out, come to terms with it. But it didn't happen. In lectures, I call this an example of what I call BS, and everybody laughs, and I say bad sociology. But, of course, it's bad history as well. And so I went to nearby schools, and this was just before massive school desegregation in the Deep South, including Mississippi. So I went to nearby black schools, high schools, and I watched this white supremacist BS being taught to all black classes by African-American teachers because they were just teaching what was in the book. So I realized that history had been a weapon, that it had been used against my students. And I eventually got a grant, and I put some people together at Tougaloo and also at Millsaps College, the nearby white college, and we wrote a new history of Mississippi. And we got it adopted by the state. That required a lawsuit because they refused to adopt it. They usually adopted 3 to 5 books in a given subject. In this subject, they only had 2 contenders, ours and theirs, but they rejected our book. So we sued them, and the lawsuit is called Lowen et al. Versus Turnipseed et al. And we won, and we got it adopted, and any school district that wanted to use it could use it and could avoid teaching this white supremacist history. But that taught me how important history was, because the state of Mississippi was taking it very seriously as a weapon to keep blacks down and keep white folks racist.
Well, my usual last question, I think I know the answer to, are things getting better? And it, well, I'll add, if they are, do you take some credit?
Well, I don't care. I'm not interested in credit for myself or not. I am interested in getting things better, both on two fronts, race relations and social justice, but also the front of historical accuracy. And I actually think that we are making progress on both of those fronts. I think the two are linked, and that is, I think that truth about the past helps us realize justice in the present. And I think the reverse is true, too. I mean, for example, one of the things I've written about, in fact, I have another book out in a reissue, Sundown Towns. These are towns across the North, mostly, that are all white on purpose, or used to be all white on purpose. Okay, I think telling the truth about these towns helps them today realize, gee, you know, maybe we might still have some race relations problems. An example of a sundown town that does have some race relations problems but isn't a sundown town anymore would be Ferguson, Missouri, for example. So I think truth about the past helps us be just in the present. And I also think that when we commit justice in the present, and my example there is toward Japanese Americans after the, you know, during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations, we apologized to Japanese Americans for incarcerating them during the Second World War. We gave them each $20,000 as kind of a restitution. Well, that didn't exactly make it right, but it's the best we could do, perhaps. And it kind of makes it a success story. And now textbooks do a great job of telling about this because we're no longer ashamed of it. So I think that justice in the present helps us tell the truth about the past, too. And I think we're going to be making continuing progress on both of these fronts.
James Lowen was a renowned sociologist, educator, and racial justice activist. He died on Thursday, August 19th. Lowen was 79. It's fair to say that James Lowen's book sent shockwaves through the academic community. And speaking of shockwaves, they're the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Shockwaves cause big changes, but look closer. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mithun Bhowmick, assistant professor in the Department of Mathematical and Physical Sciences at Miami University, takes a look at the tabletop apparatus that can influence new technologies.
Have you ever been fascinated by the fast-moving objects? If your answer is yes, you will be intrigued by shock compression experiments, where a shockwave is used to create extreme conditions in a material. When a shockwave moves through a material, it instantly delivers enormous pressure, often higher than a million atmosphere, temperature of a few thousand Fahrenheit, and lots of energy to it. At the same time, compresses it to very high density. The materials respond in many ways to shock compression. Materials often change their physical or chemical properties under shock. One of the most recent developments in shock compression is a novel apparatus we built in Dr. Dana Dillard's group at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where a tiny metal foil, moving at a few kilometers per second, hits a sample to send a shock wave through it. When the shock propagates, numerous optical probes and high-speed cameras record signature of changes from the sample. Shock compression is unique because it can investigate microscopic as well as cosmological scales. We can mimic detonation events, formation of planets, behavior of biomaterials under shock, or formation of minerals and associated geochemistry at the core of the Earth, all in real time on a tabletop apparatus. We can also apply this technique to synthesize new materials, invent clinical procedures and chemical pathways for safer, greener, and more profitable technologies. In short, shock compression on a tabletop is a rapidly growing area of interdisciplinary research, finding its applications in a multitude of problems.
And that was Mithun Bhowmick of Miami University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.